The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome to the Murthy Podcast. My name is Kevin Andrews. Today I'm joined with Maggie Wagner, and we're going to talk about non-pro-tunk requests. A non-pro-tunk request is when you have to file a late file request for extension of status or change of status because the I-94 card has already expired. Maggie, can you tell me a little bit about what this non-pro-tunk request is?
Yeah, so hi, Kevin. Non-pro-tunk is actually a Latin term. It means then for now. And essentially, it's a legal request to ask to forgive a failure for timely filing a change of status or an extension of status for a non-immigrant status. And it does allow in some circumstances to be for the approval, if granted, to be backdated based on, you know, a specific set of circumstances that we'll talk about today. But it's basically acknowledging, you know, that the change of status or the extension of status was not timely filed, and we're asking the service to approve that request anyway.
Great. Okay. So the legal requirement normally is that in order to file for an extension of status or a change of status, you need to be currently maintaining status. But if it's late and you have to make one of these late filed non-pro-tunk requests, what are the legal requirements? What are the elements for getting a successful non-pro-tunk request filed?
So there's four of them. The first one is probably the whole linchpin of the case. And the first one is probably what we'll spend the most time talking about. And that's the fact that the late filing resulted from an extraordinary circumstance beyond the applicant's control, if you're talking about an application, and beyond the petitioner's control, if you're talking about a petition. An example of an application would be an H-4, an I-539 form, and an example of a petition would be an NH-1B, an I-129. That's basically what the whole case is going to, you know, be approvable or not approvable on, because the rest of them, the second one is the foreign national has not violated their non-immigrant status otherwise, meaning if you had not, filed the change of status or extension of status late, you would not have violated your status, but for the late filed extension or change of status. That's essentially what the second prong is. And then the third one is that the foreign national remains a bona fide non-immigrant. So if you are in a status that does not allow for dual intent, like, you know, an F1 or something, you still have home ties to your foreign country. You still, you know, have a residence there. You don't have immigrant intent. And the fourth one is that the foreign national is not subject to deportation or removal proceedings. So that's pretty self-explanatory there.
Okay. So like you said, the main thing is there's some kind of extraordinary circumstances, not like a normal kind of situation. And it's not the applicant's fault. It's the result of somebody else that led to the delay in the filing. So when you're for the second part about not otherwise violating status, you know, maybe some people will be like, well, what does that mean? An example I can think of is a situation where there was, a late filed request, but this person was in H-1B status, but was violating status because they moved to a different work location and didn't file an amendment for that new location, and their I-94 later expired. So in that situation, they were not otherwise maintaining their non-immigrant status. There was already a status violation that prevented the non-pro-tunk from working in that particular case. But like you said, the main thing is the extraordinary circumstances beyond the petitioner or applicant's control. So if you're able to demonstrate that, Maggie, is non-pro-tunk request, is that a guaranteed thing? Is that something that USCIS is obligated to issue?
No. So this, you know, type of non-pro-tunk or NPT request, as it's commonly referred to, is completely discretionary. So what that means is that depending on what officer you get, you might have a better chance than others. The service isn't obligated to approve the request. So, you know, basically when you say something is very, very discretionary, it just depends on if the officer agrees with your arguments or not. And that, as we know, that can vary from officer to officer. However, you know, they're not obligated to approve that request. It is up to their discretion, but they at least have to provide a rational explanation if they decide not to use their discretion and they decide to deny the case. So that's something to look out for. If they don't provide a rational explanation for why they did not exercise their discretion, you know, that might be an opportunity to file a motion to reopen and reconsider based on the fact that they didn't provide you a rational explanation.
Yeah, and I tell people, you know, while the decision to give the non-pro-tunk relief is discretionary, the officer has a non-discretionary duty to provide a rational explanation supported by the facts. Mm-hmm. So they can't just and you're right. We have seen decisions like that where it was just the conclusion. You have not met the elements for non-pro-tunk, but without the explanation, here are the reasons why. And in those cases, sometimes we file a motion or an appeal. Sometimes we just refile. It kind of depends on the strategy. You know, it's a case by case situation. So getting the denial by itself is not the end of it. We want to make sure that they did, you know, they provided the explanation, that it's a rational explanation. It can't be, well, the sky is blue and therefore we're denying your case. That's not a rational explanation supported by the facts. That has nothing to do with the facts. So I think another way of saying this is that while the officers do have discretion to say no, because of this non-discretionary duty to give a good reason for saying no, it doesn't often come up. As long as you're giving a good, you know, you're hitting the elements of extraordinary circumstances beyond the petitioner or applicant's control. So you get this thing approved, Maggie. What does that do in terms of the approval that you get and the I-94 card and the validity period?
So it kind of depends on if you filed an extension of status or a change of status. If you file an extension of status, USCIS is supposed to grant the backdated I-94, meaning that you requested that they approve the approval with a start date of picking up wherever the gap had left you, meaning that it closes the gap on your unlawful presence because they backdated it to cover that period of time where you were, technically unlawfully present because of the untimely filed petition or application. If you file an extension, they are supposed to backdate that. If you file a change of status, you can ask them to backdate it, but it's up to their discretion of whether or not they want to grant that closure of the gap of the time that you were unlawfully present because of the untimely filed application or petition. So, in other words, if you have an extension and, you know, the petition is backdated, you no longer have that record of unlawful presence. That's cured. However, if it's a change of status and they don't backdate they decide not to use their discretion to backdate the petition, you still have that gap in status. You still have that period of unlawful presence. And, you know, that can come into play when you can butt up against some bars. So if you have over 6 months of unlawful presence and you leave, you can trigger a 3-year bar to re-enter the United States. So that's something to be aware of. After a year of unlawful presence, you trigger a 10-year bar to re-enter the United States. So if you do not have that gap closed, you're not going to want to leave the United States. And then at the green card, stage, you also will have to probably apply for a waiver for that unlawful presence.
Right. Yeah. So, and I think, and another key element, especially when we're talking about H1s and H4s also, is that, you know, for an H1B worker to have work authorization, there needs to be a labor condition application, the LCA, certified for the period of time. So if there's a status violation for somebody in H1B, for example, and there's no LCA covering that that period, USCIS may not approve it because it's like, well, you didn't have the LCA to cover the work authorization, the duration that you're asking for. And I think the similar thing would apply if the H-4, if it was a gap in an H-4 applicant status, if their H-1 spouse did not have that LCA covering, then they're not going to give the non-proton relief to the H-4 applicant. But I guess like in other case, like L-1, where there's no LCA, this is not as much of an obstacle. But there is a different regulation for extension of status versus change of status, and they're supposed to backdate with extension of status, a non-proton that's approved with extension of status. And even if it's not backdated, that's an error. That's something that USCIS should fix. But when it's a change of status, the regulation, there's a different regulation for change of status non-proton than extension non-proton, and it does not talk about backdating in that regulation. And as Maggie mentioned, I mean, in practice, we do see that, you know, sometimes the officers do anyway. That's just a human, you know, the human gloss on the law. But they don't have to. So if you have a situation where you had more than 180 days of unlawful presence, but then you get a change of status approved with the I-94 card, as Maggie mentioned, you might still have that status issue that you have to deal with at the green card stage. And, you know, in green card also, there is a provision that you can, you know, we call it the parenthetical exception to adjustment of status, that if there was a status violation that it's very similar to the non-proton language. If there was a status violation that occurred for technical reasons or through no fault of your own, that USCIS still has the discretion to approve the 485 application. So you might just have to repeat the same, essentially the elements of the same non-proton argument later on when you apply for that.
Yeah, and now might be a good time for us to elaborate on the no fault of your own piece. Basically, what that means is you need to blame somebody else. You have to make it somebody else's fault other than the applicants or the petitioners. And in H4's context, you know, you could blame, you know, the spouse. You know, they went to extend their H1B. They didn't know that they were supposed to extend the H4 along with their H1B. Because of that, you know, it's no fault of the H4 applicants. It was outside of their control. And, you know, you can use that argument. I've seen that get approved. But essentially what it means is the late filing resulting from an extraordinary circumstance beyond the applicant's control, you do have to place blame on another party. Sometimes that party can be, you know, CBP, the service. It just, you know, you have to find somebody whose fault it was other than the applicants or the petitioners.
Yeah. And I think in practice, you know, H4 non-protons tend to be easier because you can, you know, I am an H4. Maybe I'm not working. I rely on my spouse, my H1 spouse and their employer to handle this because I'm just at home, you know, taking care of the house or doing not work related things. That's a reasonable division of responsibility in a household. A common follow-up question that I have is from the H1, you know, spouse that dropped the ball. Hey, am I going to get in trouble for this? No, that's not. There's no implication. There's no adverse effect to, you know, anyone's green card journey for being a forgetful spouse. If so, maybe none of us would be here. So that's not going to create any kind of, but it's an effective strategy to help give your spouse, your H4 spouse relief. But like with H1, you know, you can't blame the employer. It's their responsibility. They're the ones. So if it's the employer just kind of winging it and not knowing, you know, just using Google and ChatGPT to figure out how to file this thing and they do it incorrectly, that's not really extraordinary circumstances beyond their control. That was well within their control. So with H1, you know, typically we look to see if there's any kind of attorney to blame. You know, maybe it's a USCIS error, depending on the case, but quite often it's an ineffective assistance of counsel. I asked my attorney if this is okay to do this. And they said, yes, this is fine. And it turns out it's not fine. And but for that advice, I would have, you know, filed what I needed to file. So if there's ineffective assistance of counsel, that can work for an H1 non-proton. But as I said, in practice, the dependent non-protons typically are easier because it's just a lower threshold to, you know, blame a spouse for being forgetful than it is on an H1 to blame an employer who's responsible for not being forgetful. I guess To cap it off here, Maggie, what's the best approach to avoid the need for getting into all this non-proton stuff to begin with?
Well, the best approach for doing a non-proton is to not get into the position where you actually need a non-proton. You know, taking steps to maintain your valid status, always check your I-94s when you travel and come back in, because that's where we see this problem arise. Technically, if it's your first entry in H1 or H4, CBP can short your I-94 to the passport expiration if it expires within 6 months of your entry. In some countries, it's up to a year of your entry. So it's always important to check the I-94 in the airport when you are issued it, because if you notice a error, then you can fix it while you're at the airport. It becomes a much bigger hassle when you go home and you realize it then, and then you have to go back to deferred inspections. So yeah, it's important to check those I-94s when you travel while you're still in the airport. And then, you know, of course, if you do overlook something and you do notice that your I-94 has expired, just consult with an attorney and, you know, see if an NPT request is something that they could do for you.
Yeah, I think generally we would say if you're noticing this error with under 180 days, probably the best solution is just to travel and get a visa stamp and come back, because being unlawfully present for 179 days is not a basis of refusing the visa. You know, if you're honest about it, this is what happened. I didn't notice my passport expired before my I-94 card, and by the time I noticed, it was day 170 and I booked my flight and now I'm here. That's fine. That, you know, the non-proton is really a necessity when, you know, you've already hit the tree. You know, you've already had the car accident. It's day 181 when we've discovered this. It's day 366 when we've discovered this. And that's probably when filing the non-proton would make the most sense.
Right. Because it becomes a risk assessment at some point. I mean, if you notice 2 months after that your I-94 has expired, you know, if you file the non-proton request and it pends, there's still a chance that it gets denied, and then it gets denied after the 6 month period, and then you do butt up against that 3 year bar.
That's a good point too. I say, like, yeah, we could file this now, but if you're, you know, especially H4 with no premium processing, you might get this decision on day, you know, 200, and if that decision is a denial, well, now you're in a worse position than you were, you know, on day 170 when you could have just traveled. So yeah, it might be an unnecessary risk to try to file a non-proton when you're under 180 days of unlawful presence. And the last thing I want to say about what you were saying about the passport and the I-94 card at the airport, you know, back in the day, they used to actually give literal stamps in the passport for your duration. And now it's an online record on CBP.gov. So, you know, in an attempt to make it more technologically convenient, it's actually a little less convenient in terms of like checking to make sure you got the right date. So I would encourage people to, you know, check CBP website. It's usually updated when you're there in the airport. But even if you see it later after you leave, you know, if the expiration is shortened because of the passport, that was not an error. You just need to file your extension before the new expiration date expires. But sometimes CBP gives the I-94 to match the visa expiration date. Right. Unless I got an old visa from a previous employer and a new petition, my old visa is valid till 2025. My new petition is valid until 2027. And they admit me until 2025 to match the visa, not the petition. That is a clear CBP error. That can be corrected. But if they're matching it to the passport expiration date, that's a reciprocity rule with the home country, and you got to, you know, use that date for purposes of filing the extension.
And it's important to remember that when that does happen, you have to renew your passport, and you also then have to go back and correct the I-94.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, with that, Maggie, I'm Kevin Andrews. Thank you, Maggie, for joining us today.
Thank you. And
everyone have a great day. Thank you.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.